Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 3, Side 1. Johnny finished dressing, packed the kit, especially Stormalong's favorite coat and scarf and goggles, and bundled it all up. "You will be sure this gets to Stormalong," said Johnny. But as Lars said nothing, Johnny decided to take it along. They had done it. How he would get himself out of this mess, he didn't know. He was a little puzzled as to why the other two had driven off when the battle plane must still be down there. But he was grateful they were out of it. "Let's go," he said. 5. They exited from a different ground-level door, one that was usually locked. Johnny glanced around for a cadet to give Stormalong's kit to and saw no one. "I'll see that it's taken to the academy," said Lars, divining his purpose. He must not see too deeply into the dispositions Lars had made, most of which prevented them from being seen by anyone, lest Lars find himself with a battle on his hands from cadets or Russians, some of whom had just arrived at the underground base in the mountains and were a considerable force. A storm was coming in from over the mountains, rolling black clouds studded with lightning around the distant high peak. The wind was picking up and bending the tall brown grass. A few dead leaves fled through the air. Autumn was here. There was a chill in the air on this mile-high plateau. It gave Johnny an eerie feeling, almost a premonition. He had left Africa in a storm, and here was a storm again. He threw the kit in the back and got in. The windows were darkened so no one could see in. With submachine guns trained upon him, they drove toward the capital. Lars was a bad driver, and Johnny could see how he must have gotten the cracked neck the plaster cast advertised. Johnny despised him. Johnny had known lots of Swedes, and they were good people. He had even gathered from Lars's conversation that they despised him, too. The man tried to chatter on about the ancient military leader, but Johnny had had enough. "Shut up," he said from the back. "You're nothing but a turncoat traitor. I don't see how you can stand yourself, so shut up." It was unwise, but he couldn't go on listening to this insanity. Lars shut up, but his eyes slitted. He suddenly enjoyed the fact that this criminal would be dead in a few hours. The ground car squatted down at a side entrance to the capital never used. There were no people to be seen. There were no people in the corridor either. Lars had seen to that. They thrust him toward a door. Unseen brigantes in the shadows kept their guns trained upon him. Two more were in the courtroom in the corners, Thompson's cocked and ready. And there sat Brown Limper. He was at a high desk on a dais. He was in a black robe. Ancient law books flanked him on either side. His face had an unhealthy sheen. His eyes were too bright. He loomed like a vulture about to attack a corpse. Just himself, the Brigante guards, and this Tyler in an otherwise empty room. It was Tyler. He had recognized that the moment the fellow strode through the door. There was an air about this Tyler one couldn't miss. He had hated it since they were children. Hated that easy, confident walk. Hated that set of even features. Hated those light blue eyes. He had hated everything Tyler was and he could never be. But who had the power now? He, Brown Limper. How he had daydreamed of this moment. "Tyler," said Brown Limper, "come stand in front of the court bench. Answer me. Is your name Johnny Goodboy Tyler?" Brown Limper had a recorder running. Such proceedings must be regular and legal. Johnny came to a board stand in front of the bench. "What is this farce, Brown Limper? You know my name well enough."
"Silence," said Brown Limper, hoping his voice was resonant and deep. "The prisoner will answer correctly and properly or become guilty of contempt of court."
"I see no court," said Johnny. "What are you doing in that funny dress?"
"Tyler, I am adding contempt of court to these charges." Add what you please, said Johnny, bored with it.
You will not consider this lightly when I read you what you are charged with. This, at present, is just a hearing. In a week or two, a world court will be established and the trial will take place at that time. But as a felon and criminal, you have the right to hear the charges so that you can organize your defense when tried. Now, hear ye, hear ye. You are charged with a count of murder in the first degree, the victims being the Champco brothers, loyal employees of the state, feloniously assaulted with intent to kill and later dying by their own hand due to pain of their wounds. Kidnapping in the first degree, the said Tyler assaulting and feloniously seizing the persons of two coordinators going about their legal duties as agents of the council. Murder and felonious assault upon a peace-loving and unoffending tribe called the Brigantes, including the slaughter of half a commando. Massacre of a convoy of peaceful commercial people going about their business and viciously and maliciously slaughtering them to the last man.
Cyclos, said Johnny. They were cyclos organizing an attack upon this capital.
That's stricken from the records, said Brown Limper.
Indeed, he would have to erase it from this disk.
You are not on trial. These are just the charges that have been brought against you by decent and deserving citizens of this planet. Remain silent and hear the charges.
It is noted by the court, continued Brown Limper, how he had slaved over this parlance from ancient books. He hoped he had it all right and legal.
That numerous other charges could be brought, but at this time have not been brought.
Such as, said Johnny, indifferent to this clown.
When you seized the remote control panel from one Turl and launched the drone against man, it has also been stated that you then and thereupon shot down said Turl when he was in the act of trying to shoot down the drone. However, there being witnesses, undoubtedly perjured and extorted by you to speak false testimony, who speak otherwise, the charges have not been included at this time, though of course they may be brought at some later date.
So that's all you could come up with, said Johnny, with irony. Nothing about stealing baby's milk? I'm surprised.
You won't be so arrogant when you hear the rest of this, threatened Brown Limper. I am an impartial judge, and this is a legal and impartial court. In the interim time pending your trial, you are forbidden to use any more of my, council property, such as planes, cars, houses, equipment, or tools.
Brown Limper had him. Quick as a flash, he pulled out the bill of sale of the Earth branch of the Intergalactic Mining Company and thrust it at Tyler. Tyler took it and looked at it. For a sum of 2 billion credits, one Turl, duly authorized representative of the Party of the First Part, which shall hereafter be called the Party of the First Part, did hereby convey all lands, mines, mine sites, compounds, planes, tools, machinery, cars, tanks, on and on, to the Council of Earth, the duly elected and authorized government of said planet, to have and to hold forever and from this day forward. It was signed Turl, but Johnny, who knew Turl's signature, saw that it must have been written with the wrong paw. He started to put it in his pouch.
No, no! Shouted Brown Limper. That is the original.
He fussed around in the papers on his desk and handed over a copy and exchanged it for the original. Johnny put the copy in his pouch.
And not only that, said Brown Limper, the whole planet was the property of Intergalactic, and there is a deed for that as well.
He started to hand over the original, thought better of it, found a copy, and handed it over. Johnny glanced at it. Turl had actually sold these fools their planet.
The deeds are valid, said Brown Limper pompously. That is, they will be when fully recorded.
Where? Said Johnny.
On Cyclo, of course, said Brown Limper. Out of the goodness of his heart and in spite of the trouble, Turl himself will take these deeds there and get them fully recorded.
When? Said Johnny.
Just as soon as he can rebuild the apparatus you feloniously and maliciously destroyed, Tyler.
And he's taking the money with him?
Of course. He has to turn it into his company. He is an honest man.
Cyclo, corrected Johnny.
Cyclo, corrected Brown Limper,
and then instantly became furious with himself for permitting this judicial proceeding to assume other than a judicial tone. "So, therefore," said Brown Limper, reading, "and as stated, notwithstanding, in accordance with the legal tribal rights of the said Johnny Goodboy Tyler, he is hereby placed under house arrest in his own home in the meadow, and is herewith and hereby not to quit said home and said vicinity until haled before a world court, duly to be constituted under the authority of the council, said council being duly elected and invested with the total authority of total government of earth. Hey man." He had thought the last religious note gave it style, and he now sat proudly on the bench. "So, unless the prisoner has some last request?" Johnny had been thinking hard and quickly. He had never before paid much attention to Brown Limper, and such malice, falsehood, and evil was a little surprising. There was a fueled battle plane in the hangar at the compound. "Yes," said Johnny, "there is a request. If I'm going to the meadow, I would like to pick up my horses first." "Those and your house are all the property you own now, so it is only fit that you do so. Out of courtesy and feelings for the rights of the prisoner, and possibly even out of a fatherly feeling for him as his own mayor, I grant request, so long as you go at once from there straight to the village in the meadow and into your house." Johnny looked at him with contempt and strode from the room. Brown Limper, eyes overbright, watched him go. That would be the end of Tyler. He let out a shuddering sigh. What a relief all this was. And how long sought? 20 years. No, this was not revenge. He had to do it. Duty demanded it. The peoples of Earth would now be wholly in good hands. His, Brown Limper's. He would do his very best for them, as he was doing now, despite the toil it cost him. 6. The incident that would later become known as the murder of Biddy McLeod, which would bring the planet toward war, cost many men their lives, and later become the subject of ballads, romances, and legend, began at noon that day, with Biddy's unfortunate spotting of Johnny in the capital area of Denver. When the head of the Russian contingent had been given orders in Africa to close the American underground base, it was very plain to the Russians that neither they nor Johnny would thereafter be residents in America, which brought up the subject of horses. Horses were wealth to the Russians. They had developed a small herd of their own in America, and they were not going to abandon them. Biddy McLeod considered himself responsible for Johnny's horses. He informed Colonel Ivan in no uncertain terms that he must go along with them to bring back Johnny's horses. When objections were raised, he doggedly countered them. He was with the Russians, and he would be safe. The horses knew him. Windsplitter, Dancer, Old Pork, and Blodgett would be frightened on the long plane ride unless they had somebody soothing them they knew they could trust. After hours of this, Colonel Ivan gave in. The Russians, just before dawn of that day, had thoroughly closed the American underground base as well as the nuclear missile store. If anyone tried to get into them now who didn't know the way or have the keys, they would be blown to bits. Planes had been arranged for the return. Any material they were taking back aboard was already loaded, and before dawn that day, they had left the base in a small convoy of trucks and cars to do their last job, pick up the horses from the planes. The way from the base led through the ancient ruins of Denver, and few of the Russians had ever been there. Further, recently they had begun to get paid. They were going home, and they had sisters and wives and sweethearts, mothers and friends. A few tiny stores had opened lately in Denver, the proprietors from other places, the customers, the people of the world, making pilgrimages to the mine site. The goods were salvaged and repaired items from the ruins of sprawling cities, and even some new products of native tribes. Dresses, shoes, cloth, jewelry, utensils, souvenirs, and relics were the main stocks in trade. The stores were few and widely scattered. The Russians decided that since they were many hours early for their departure time that evening from the academy field, and since they did not favor sitting around in the grass waiting, they would spend a little shopping time in Denver. They had parked their vehicles near the Capitol, for there was much space there, and its dome could be seen from all around as a landmark and gotten back to easily. They had scattered out, each on his own errands. Biddy had been given a special guard, a strong, tough Russian who was a special friend of Biddy's, named Dmitry Tomlov. And Dmitry had been charged by Colonel Ivan to stay close to Biddy and not be careless, and to carry his assault rifle and magazine pouch wherever he went. So it seemed all right. Biddy and his guardian had found a little jewelry and trinket shop that had been opened by an old Swiss couple and their son. The old Swiss had found and repaired an engraving machine. He was also clever with repairing items found in ancient wrecked stores, where and when they had been overlooked by metal-hungry cyclos. The son was in a back room of the shop, recovering from trying to defend the store from being robbed by the Brigantes. It seemed the Brigantes would go around telling everyone they were police, and they carried clubs and would pick up anything that took their fancy and put it in their pockets. The council, when approached by the few people now in Denver, had admitted that, yes, the Brigantes were police, and that law and order was vital, and that it was a felony to resist police. Nobody really knew what police meant as a word, but they had come to realize it was something very bad. So the old Swiss had decided to move away, and a lot of his items were for sale at very low prices. The wife was waiting on Dmitry. He had lots of relatives, but his first purchase was a little silver-headed riding crop for Biddy. Although Biddy would have been aghast at the idea of hitting a horse, the crop looked very nice. It was about 2 feet long, about the length of a Brigante bow, although no one noticed this at the time. Despite all these very low prices, Biddy was having a rough time. He wanted something special for Patty. He thought he would be seeing her shortly. He looked and looked, helped by the old man. Also, Biddy did not have very much money with him. His pay was only 2 credits a week, whereas a soldier's was 1 credit a day. Pay had not been going on very long, so Biddy only had 4 credits, and the better items were as much as 10. Biddy's problems were also complicated by the limited command of English on the part of the Swiss people, who spoke a combination of German and French. The Russian was no help. He had practically no English, and nobody spoke Russian there, including Biddy. But they were making out with signs and count marks on scraps of wrapping paper and raised eyebrows and pointing fingers. At last, Biddy found it. It was a real gold-plated locket in the shape of a heart. It had a red rose, still bright red, inset on it. It opened, and you could put pictures inside, and it had had its hinge nicely repaired, and it had a thin chain. Also, it had enough space on the back to engrave something. And, yes, the old Swiss would be happy to engrave it. With 1 credit for the engraving, it all came to 6 credits. It was the very thing. But 6 credits. He only had 4. Well, the old Swiss was selling out, and when he saw the disappointment on Biddy's face, he relented and let him have it, with a box thrown in, all engraved, repolished, and ready to go. When given a card to put the message on so it could be copied, Biddy fell into more difficulty. What was he going to put on the back of the locket? Johnny and others had told him that he and Patty were far too young to get married, and that was true. So he couldn't put, "To my future wife," really, for people might smile, and this was no smiling matter. He didn't want simply to put, "To Patty, love Biddy," as the old Swiss seemed to be suggesting. The Russian was no help at all. Then he had it. "To Patty, my lady fair, Biddy." The old Swiss then said that was too long to fit on the back. So he had to come back, after all, to Patty, my future wife. The old Swiss counted that up and said he could fit that in. It wasn't too satisfactory and people might laugh, but he couldn't do any better, and the old Swiss set up his engraving machine and had at it. All this was taking time, and Biddy was getting edgy. He might miss the Russians, and after all, Johnny's horses were his job as squire, and that's why he had come over to America. He hopped from one foot to the other and pushed at them all to hurry. The Swiss finally finished and put the locket in a nice box and wrapped it in some old paper, and the Russian finally got all the things he wanted, and they paid it all up and went rushing out to get back to the trucks. It was a cold day. There had been a frost, and dead leaves were blowing about. A storm was rumbling over the mountains. It all seemed to tell Biddy to hurry. But when they got back to the trucks, the position of the sun, seen through scudding cloud, said it was only noon. There were no Russians returned. The guard got into the driver's seat of their cab and began to sort out the presents he had bought. Biddy, almost engulfed by the huge cyclo passenger seat, closed the window against the chill wind and dead flying leaves, and sat there impatiently twiddling his new riding crop and looking out the window, his eyes just above the level of the bottom, keeping watch for the rest of the Russians. From where he sat, he could see a side entrance to the Capitol building. There was a big executive ground car sitting there with blacked-out windows. Suddenly, he saw Sir Johnny. There he was, dressed as usual in buckskin, unmistakable. He walked out of the side entrance of the Capitol. The door of the executive ground car was swung open from inside, and Johnny got into it. Biddy scrambled to get down the window and shout. He got it open part way. He couldn't get it all the way down. Then somebody else came out of the Capitol, somebody dressed like a cadet, a plaster cast around his neck. This second person stopped and called back into the Capitol stairway, where somebody must have asked a question. The man in cadet clothes yelled back, "He's just going down to the compound first to pick up his horses." Then he, too, got into the ground car and it started up. Biddy was wild. He hadn't been able to get the window down and call to Sir Johnny. Get the horses? That was why he was here, what he'd come all the way to America to do. He tried to get his guard to just start up the truck and follow. But Biddy's command of Russian was not up to it. Gestures and motions and repeating the sense of what he was saying got no place. This Russian was not about to go after that executive ground car. He was here to wait for the rest of the contingent. But Biddy got him out of the cab, and they went sprinting around looking for the rest of the Russians. Minutes went by, and they couldn't find them. This ruined city was too big, too spread out, too filled with rubble. Suddenly they spotted one Russian. He was walking along the edge of a park by himself, eating some nuts he had bought. He was a man named Amir, and he had no reputation for being quick in the wits, although he was a nice fellow. Biddy reeled off the situation to him, using gestures and a Russian word he did know. Skoryeyi, meaning hurry up, and trying to get the man to understand he was to find the others and tell them to come along right away. He was not at all sure the man got it, for he looked blank, but the action was enough to convince Dmitri that it was now all right to follow the ground car, so they got back to the truck and the Russians started it up, and they went roaring out of the city to catch up to the vehicle Biddy had seen Johnny enter. 7. Lars Thorensen had taken every precaution. He had gone over it very carefully. If there was no public display of arms and guards, while making sure that this Tyler was thoroughly covered at all times by adequate weaponry, then no alert would go out and no misguided friends of this felon would come pouring around to rescue him. Lars had left guards in the car, had let no other Brigantes appear on the streets or openly in corridors, had sent word to the commando now posted at the compound to keep out of sight but ready and not to shoot unless attacked. He had a little surprise for this Tyler at the compound, but all should go smoothly and well. He thought even Hitler would have approved of the tactical skills Lars was displaying. They would pick up the horses, drive up through the pass to the meadow, order this Tyler to go into his own house, and that would be that. The scourge and menace to the stability of the state would be ended, thoroughly and with no blame at all to the council. The day had gone gray. The sun was more and more overcast. The wind was picking up, and billows of dust and clouds of dead grass were running before the approaching storm. Lars's driving was not all that good to begin with, and gusts were buffeting the ground car, swerving it from already badly chosen courses. He was not driving fast. Johnny was considering his chances. He had no idea they intended to let him out of this alive, for all their smooth assurances. What point of that plaster cast, if hit, would finish the job of breaking this traitor's neck? How familiar were these two evil-smelling Brigantes with a Thompson submachine gun? The weapon, deadly though it was, had been obsolete for a century at the time of the Cyclo attack. It fired pistol ammunition that was too heavy for a handheld automatic weapon, and caused it to kick upward furiously so that you had to hold the muzzle down with great force. These weapons they had were not equipped with cuts compensators that used some of the muzzle blast to help hold down the upward kick. They were loaded with 60-shot drums, and the springs of those drums were often weak and failed to feed. A certain percentage of the very ancient ammunition failed to fire, and one had to know the trick of re-cocking rapidly to keep the gun shooting on automatic. Johnny knew these things, for he had fired a lot of practice rounds with them when Angus had first dug them out of the old camion, where they had lain through the ages, protected by heavy grease and airtight ammunition packaging. But did the Brigantes? Probably they had fired a few rounds with them, the first firing of powder missile weapons they had ever done in their lives. The improbable and rapidly discarded ploy had occurred to him to talk to them about the weapon, and then take one to explain a fine point and blow their foul, matted heads off. Unless he thought of something, this was going to be his last ride. It was in Lars's manner. It was in the looks the Brigantes gave him. They were very, very confident. The compound appeared in the distance ahead of them. There was some stock scattered about in the plains. Lars narrowly avoided a group of buffalo, dodged a scrub tree, nearly dumped them in a gully, jolted them over some boulders anyone who could drive would have avoided, and finally halted about 100 feet short of the beginning of the rise that ended in the plateau near the cage. It was not as close to the compound as Johnny had expected them to stop, and then he saw the reason for it. The ground, aside from some boulders, was open, and a man trying to run away could be cut down. There were his horses, three of them standing with their heads away from the wind. Where was Dancer? Then he saw her. She was up on the plateau, and she seemed to be wearing a lead rope, not too unusual. She wasn't facing away from the wind. What was that? Ah, her lead rope was caught in some rocks. Just beyond her was a large boulder, and beyond that the compound itself offered numerous points of cover for a marksman, as they had learned to their concern in the old battle here. Johnny looked at it through the windscreen. What was this, some kind of ambush or trap? Where one expected some cadet sentries, there wasn't a soul in sight. Now Lars chose his moment to spring his little compound surprise. He had read in the works of Hitler, or was it Turl? If you want someone to remain inactive, crush their hope, then guide false hope into a new channel where you can finish them off. It was an extremely wise military maxim. Lars, lolling easily now over the console, said, "You know that battle plane, the one with the serial ending in 93, that was parked and refueled just inside the hangar door? I'm sure you know the one I mean. Well, it isn't there anymore. The fuel was removed from it, and it was put way back in the hangar out of sight this morning." So that was why Angus and Kerr didn't stop when they left, thought Johnny. They saw no battle plane, and thought he had flown safely away. This accounted for no one showing up to trace him. Well, he hadn't expected any help anyway. And it was a very good thing they had not walked in on these nervous Brigantes and their submachine guns. The traitor let him digest the surprise and then said, "But we won't be riding horses to the meadow. I will go down to the garage and get a stake truck, and we can load the mounts in, and I might even be persuaded to let you drive into the mountains." He had no intention of doing that, but it was a good false hope. In fact, masterful. Hitler, or was it Turl, would have approved.
"You can get out and start collecting the horses. The two Brigantes here will keep you covered."
Lars got out and jogged off in the direction of the garage entrance on the other side of the compound. Johnny was pushed out with gun muzzles, and he stood on the left side of the car, a Brigante on either side of him, with their guns on him and fingers on the trigger. He was studying the apparently unpeopled compound. Was this the assassination area? 8. Johnny heard the rumble of a truck above the wind. He looked to the north. An empty truck was approaching at considerable speed, the occupants of the cab invisible to him in this light. From behind that truck to the horizon in the north, it was only empty plain, no other vehicles. He heard another rumble. A plane? He spotted it in the east, approaching slowly just below the overcast. Only a slow-flying drone, scanning for its endless millions of pictures. Well, no real help was coming from those directions. He was on his own. The truck, now quite near, was probably one of theirs and part of this snare. Johnny looked back at the compound. He had a feeling of watchful eyes and danger there. The two Brigante guards were on either side of him, about a pace to the rear. They seemed to be watching this new truck. That they held guns was masked from the truck's view by the ground car's bulk. The huge vehicle roared on by them on the other side of the ground car. It went a short distance up the rise toward Dancer. It stopped suddenly, banging to earth in a cloud of dust as its suspension drive cut off. Somebody leaped down through the dust from the 8-foot height of the cab floor and began to run up the slope toward Dancer. Johnny couldn't believe his eyes. It was Biddy McLeod. He was carrying something in his hand. A crop? A switch?
"Biddy!" shouted Johnny in alarm.
The boy's voice floated back to him, carried by the wind.
"I'll get the horses, Sir Johnny. That's my job."
Biddy was racing up on the hill.
"Come back!" shouted Johnny.
But the throb of the drone and a rumble of thunder in the mountains drowned his voice. The Russian had had trouble getting his truck level. It had tilted on a boulder. But now he flung open the door and shouted toward Biddy,
"Bitushka! Ostanovka!"
Halt. A sudden spurt of wind and the drone muted his words.
"Vazvratne!"
Return. The boy ran on. He was almost too Dancer to free the lead rope.
"Lord God, Biddy, come back!" screamed Johnny.
It was too late. From behind a boulder just beyond the horse, a Brigante stood up, raised his submachine gun, and fired at full burst directly into the stomach of the running boy. Biddy was slammed back, pummeled by bullets that drove his body into the air. He crashed to earth. The Russian was running forward, trying to unsling the assault rifle from his back, trying to get to Biddy. Two more Brigantes rose into view in different places, and three Thompsons roared. The Russian was cut to pieces. Johnny went berserk. The two Brigante guards stood no chance. With one backward stride, Johnny was behind them. He sent them slamming together like eggshells. He caught the gun of one as that Brigante went down and stamped his heel into the side of the mercenary's skull, crushing it. He reversed the gun and battered the other Brigante with bullets from a range of 3 inches. Johnny dropped on one knee, turned the Thompson on its side so its kick would fan the bullets, and blew the last two Brigantes who had risen to bits. He spun to find the one who had shot Biddy. That one was not in sight. 5 Brigantes rushed from a door in the compound and sent a hail of lead in his direction. The Thompson he had used was jammed. It would not recock. He threw it down and picked up the other one. Totally unmindful of the slugs ripping up the ground, running low and firing as he went, he raced forward toward the fallen Russian. He knelt behind the body, turned the Thompson on its side, and fanned a storm of bullets into the 5. They crashed back against the compound, bodies jerking as a second spray of slugs hit them before they could even collapse. Johnny got the assault rifle off the Russian and yanked its slide to get a bullet in the chamber. He was after the Brigante who had shot Biddy. To his left and behind him, 8 mercenaries who had been lying in wait in the ravine rushed into view. Johnny whirled. Then he stood there, braced, until the last one was out of the ravine. They came on, firing. Johnny raised the assault rifle to his shoulder and took careful aim. He shot the last in the line first, so the others would not see him go down, and then fanned a barrage of shots from there to the first one in the lead. The squad came sprawling forward in an avalanche of dead men. Down in the garage, Lars heard the firing. He sprinted up toward the plateau. Then he heard the assault rifles, sharper bark, racketing against the compound. Instantly he knew that Johnny was not dead. No Brigantes had assault rifles. This intermediate ammunition, halfway between a pistol and a rifle, was far more accurate than a Thompson. He knew. He had tried to get some, and he could not. He halted. There was another prolonged burst from the assault rifle. The heavier staccato thud of the submachine guns had dwindled. Lars suddenly hit upon a better course of action for himself. He scuttled backward into the garage. He sprinted into its depths. He found an old wrecked car, and he crawled under the heaps of damaged body plates stripped from it. A far-off hammer of the assault rifle again. He burrowed deeper, sobbing with terror. Johnny raced over to the side to get a view behind the boulder, still trying to nail the mercenary who had shot Biddy. A group of Brigantes sprinted into sight on the other side of the compound, firing submachine guns as they came. Johnny braced himself on a rock, fired over its top, and riddled them. Turl, in his cage, had dropped down below the parapet that held the upright bars, lying flat to be out of the path of bullets. He raised himself cautiously now. It was the animal. He ducked back. At any moment now, he supposed the animal would charge over here and riddle him. It's what Turl would have done. He wondered whether he could get to the hidden explosive charge in the cage and make a grenade out of it, and then he saw he would expose himself if he did so, and abandoned the idea. He lay there, panting a little in fear. Taking advantage of trees and boulders, running from one to the next with deadly purpose, Johnny was still trying to get the Brigante who had shot Biddy. The wind was rising. Thunder was sounding amid the gunfire. The slow-flying drone was very near overhead now. Where was that Brigante? 2 mercenaries jumped into view in a door and bore down on him with Thompsons. A bullet flicked the side of his neck. Johnny pounded them into rolling balls of dead flesh with the assault rifle. He snapped in a fresh magazine from the bag. The ape he was looking for must have taken refuge back of a wrecked tractor. Johnny probed it with bullets fired to ricochet behind it. Running, he rushed it, firing as he went. There he was. The Brigante ran away. Johnny sighted in on him. The Brigante turned and started to shoot. Johnny sliced him in 2 with the assault rifle. The sound of the drone grew less. There was no thunder at the moment. Save for the moan of the wind, it seemed strangely quiet. Johnny put another magazine in the assault rifle. He quickly walked over the ground, glancing at one or another of the strewn dead. A mercenary was crawling, trying to get his hands on a Thompson. Johnny put a burst into him. He waited. There seemed to be no sound or movement in the area that would be dangerous. Dancer had broken free in the firing and fled down the slope. Johnny held the assault rifle ready in the crook on his arm. His battle rage died. He went down the slope to Biddy. 9. The little boy lay on the blood-stained ground, his head back and in the direction of the lower slope. Johnny had been certain he was dead. Nobody could take that many submachine gun slugs in the middle of his body, and a small body, and live. He felt awful. He knelt beside the torn boy. He was going to pick the body up, and he put his hand under the head and lifted it slightly. There was a light flutter of breath. Biddy's eyes trembled open. They were glazed in shock, but they saw Johnny, knew him. Biddy was moving his lips, a very faint whisper of a voice. Johnny bent closer to hear.
I wasn't a very good squire, was I, Sir Johnny?
Then tears began to roll sideways from the boy's eyes. Johnny reacted, incredulous. The child thought he had failed. Johnny tried to get it out, tried to speak. He couldn't make his voice work. He was trying to tell Biddy, "No, no, no, Biddy. You were a great squire. You have just saved my life." But he couldn't speak. The shock was wearing off in the boy. The numbness that had held back the pain vanished. Biddy's hand, which had risen to clutch Johnny's wrist, suddenly clenched bruisingly in a spasm of agony. The body did a wrenching twist. Biddy's head fell to the side. He was dead. No heartbeat, no breath, no pulse. Johnny sat there for a long time, crying. He hadn't been able to speak, to tell Biddy how wrong he was. He was not a bad squire. Not Biddy. Never. After a while, Johnny picked the boy up in his arms and went down the hill. He laid the body very gently on the seat of the ground car. He went back and picked up the dead body of the Russian and carried it to the car and put it in. Windsplitter had seen him from a distance and came up, and the other horses, over their fright now, approached. Johnny put the dead boy on his lap and drove very slowly toward the academy. The horses, seeing him go at that pace, followed. The little cortege crossed the plain. It took them a long time to make the trip. Johnny stopped at last beside the trench where the 67 cadets had fought the last battle so very long ago. He just sat there holding Biddy's body. A cadet sentry had seen them approach. In a little while, cadets started to come out of the buildings. Word spread further and more came. The schoolmaster, from an upper window, saw the crowd gathering around the ground car and went out. Dunnell Dean and Angus and Care came up to the fringe of the crowd. Johnny got out, holding the dead boy. He wanted to talk to them, and he couldn't speak. Several truckloads of Russians suddenly roared up to a halt, and they spilled out, joining the crowd. Several cadets raced back to the armory and came out with assault rifles and shoulder bags of magazines, and began to pass them around to men who were looking in the direction of the compound. An angry mutter was rising higher and higher among them. Several cadets raced back to their rooms to get personal sidearms and came back, buckling on belts and loading magazines. The thunder of the mountains reverberated now and then across the plain, and an angry cold wind whipped around the mob. A truckload of Russians who had swung over by the compound arrived back and stopped in a geyser of dust. The Russians were shouting and pointing toward the compound, trying to say what was over there now. No one could understand them. A small ground car raced up from the direction of Denver, spraying clods of dirt as it screeched to a stop. The pilot officer in charge of drones jumped out, a stream of drone printout pictures crackling in the wind as he forced his way into the crowd, trying to tell them it had all come through on a drone overfly, trying to show people what had happened. He had ripped the printouts and the discs out of the machines and come at once. A coordinator was finally able to make himself heard. He had gotten now what the single Russian truck had seen at the compound.
"The Brigantes are all dead over there, a whole commando. Is that Cyclo Turtle still alive over there?"
somebody shouted. There was an angry roar from the crowd. Several surged forward to see whether Turtle was visible in the pictures.
"He's still alive,"
shouted the Russians' coordinator, who had gotten the information from the truck. The crowd surged, and some started to climb into the Russian trucks. The Russians had been drawn up in a line by a Russian officer, and they were checking their rifles on command. Colonel Ivan, who had come to stand near Johnny, was gazing, stricken with guilt, at the face of the dead boy.
"This Cyclo dies."
Johnny had finally gotten a grip on himself. Still holding the boy, He climbed to the top of the ground car. He looked down at them, and they quieted to hear him. "No," said Johnny. "No, you must not do anything now."
Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 3, Side 2. "No," said Johnny. "No, you must not do anything now. In the star systems of the universe around us, there is a far greater danger than Brigantes. We are fighting a dangerous battle, a bigger battle. We have made a mistake, and it has resulted in the death of this innocent boy. I killed his murderer. We cannot undo the mistake, but we must go on. In that trench there, 67 cadets died, fighting the last battle of the Cyclo invasion over 1,000 years ago. When I first saw that trench, it gave me my first hope. It was not that they lost. It was that they fought it all against hopeless odds. They did not die in vain. We are here. We are fighting again. You and your fellow pilots control the skies of Earth. I will make a request of one or another of you in times to come. Will you honor those requests? There was a masked stare. Did he think they would not? Then there was a concerted roar of assent. It took minutes for it to quiet. Johnny said, "I am leaving you now. I am taking this boy to Scotland, to be buried by his own people." Johnny got down off the car. The pilot, whose ore carrier had been readied for the Russians, was pointing it out to the Russian coordinator. They loaded Johnny's horses. They found Stormalong's kit in the ground car and put it aboard. The Russians took over the body of Dmitry Tomlov to take it home. Johnny climbed to the cockpit of the big ore carrier, still holding Biddy. Before he closed the door, he looked down at the crowd and said, slowly and clearly, "It is not the time for revenge." And then he added a bitter, grim, "Yet." The crowd nodded. They understood. Later it would be an entirely different matter. The huge plane rose and turned in the gray, storm-discolored sky. It dwindled and was gone. 10. A much more serious crisis awaited him in Scotland, one that threatened to wreck all his plans. Pilots on the ground talked the ore plane down through the dark, swirling mists of autumn. The Scots had begun to rebuild Castle Rock in Edinburgh, cleaning up and trying to restore the ancient buildings that 2,000 years before had been the seat of Scottish nationalism, and that was now being called its original Gaelic word, Dunedin, the hill fort of Eden. Johnny landed in a park below the rock, just in front of the ruins of the ancient National Gallery of Scotland. Swarms of people had been there to meet him, and Gillies had been hard-pressed to clear space in the throng for the plane to land. Unfortunately, the drone pictures of the compound fight had come in on the Cornwall minesite recorders, and they had been rushed by mine passenger plane to Scotland long before Johnny's arrival. The Scots were making good use of the vast amounts of transport taken from the cyclos, and flatbeds were being used as buses now that trainee machine operators were back home. Biddy's mother and family were there, and Johnny gave over the corpse to them to dress and prepare for a funeral. Pipers were wailing a lament, drums beating its slow and doleful cadence. Women in the crowd were openly crying, and men were beating their fists together as they dwelt on what they conceived to be the necessity of war. It was nearly dark. An honor guard of kilted Highlanders approached, and its officer courteously told Johnny he was there to escort him through the crowds to a meeting of the chiefs. They had not yet restored the Parliament House on the rock. The chiefs, brought hastily in from the hills, were meeting in the nearby open park before the ruined Royal Scottish Academy. To the mournful cry of pipes, Johnny walked toward the space. It was lit with a towering bonfire in its center. The flame's glow was flickering over the buckles and swords of clan chiefs and their retainers. It was an assembly with only one single-minded purpose: war. Belatedly, Robert the Fox, just in from Africa, rushed to Johnny's side. They were already on the outskirts of the assembly, the honor guard opening the way, heading for some raised stone slabs that served as a rostrum. Clan Chief Fergus was coming forward in courtesy to escort him to this rostrum.
"Do you want war?" said Robert the Fox into Johnny's ear. "I think not. It would ruin all your plans."
"No, no," said Johnny. "That is the last thing we want. Without it, we have a chance."
"Then why," said Sir Robert, "didn't you change your clothes before this meeting? You might have known it would take place."
Johnny had not thought about his clothes. He glanced down. The buckskin shoulder was dark red from the bleeding of the superficial wound at the side of his neck, long since staunched by coagulation. The entire front of his shirt and his trousers down to the knee were saturated with Bitty's blood. At that very moment, the chief of the Campbells was speaking to the assembled chiefs.
"And I say, this is a blood feud that can only be settled in war."
There was a savage roar of agreement.
"War! War!"
Lochaber axes were flashing in the light of the leaping flames. The slither of swords coming from their sheaths was a deadly martial declaration. Johnny stepped up on the stone rostrum. He held up his hand for quiet. They gave him a silence electric with tension and punctuated by the crackling flame of the bonfire.
"We want no war," said Johnny.
It was the wrong thing to say. A clamor of disagreement rolled at him.
"By the very blood on his clothes," shouted the chief of the Argyles, "this cries out for war."
"The murderer of the boy is dead," said Johnny.
"What of Alison?"
cried the chief of the Camerons.
"His vile murder has not been avenged. The chief of the Brigantes, he that brought it about, still lives. These are matters of blood feud."
Johnny realized they were out of control. They were demanding pilots and transport. Their target was the obliteration of the entire force of Brigantes. And now. He knew this had all been decided before his arrival on the slow ore carrier. He could see all their labors going for nothing. If that area in America were wiped out, that would end their plans. He looked for the face of Robert the Fox and found only this sea of enraged chiefs and retainers. He did not dare tell them so openly and in public of his plans. Lars had shown there could be traitors. He tried to tell them the planet was under a much greater threat, that they did not really know what had happened to Cyclo, that there were other races out in the stars. But not one single word he said was heard in the tumult. Finally, the big and lordly chief of Clan Fergus leaped up beside him and bellowed at the throng,
"Let the MacTyler speak!"
They quieted under that, tense, determined. Johnny was tired. He had not slept for days. He summoned up reserves of energy and spoke in a strong, confident voice.
"I can promise you successful war, if you will let me guide you. If you will each one contribute men and time to a daring enterprise, if you will but plan with me and work in preparation for the next few months, we will have war, we will have revenge, and we will have a chance of everlasting victory."
They heard that. After a moment, while it sank in, they burst into a savage din of agreement. The Lochaber axes were raised higher. Claymores flashed back the light of flames. The pipes suddenly burst into the stirring tunes of war. They hailed Johnny until they were hoarse. As he stepped down and was led away by Robert the Fox, big hands clapped him on the back as he passed. Others sought to grip his. Men leaped before him, claymores held before their faces in devoted salutes. Somebody started a chant of,
"MacTyler! MacTyler! MacTyler!"
The pipes screamed and drums added to the din.
"Count on you, laddie," said Robert the Fox fondly, as he led Johnny off to temporary quarters in an old house, a bath, clean clothes, and rest.
"But I'm only hoping we can deliver." They buried Biddy MacLeod the next day in a crypt in the old Cathedral St. Giles. The funeral procession was over a mile long. To the chief of Clan Fergus, Johnny had said, "He died a squire. We must bury him as a knight." Placing a robe on the corpse, Fergus, as titular King of Scotland, and now the entire British Isles, knighted Biddy with a tender touch of a sword. A rock carver had worked straight through to complete a sarcophagus, a stone casket, and it was ready. The parson read the funeral oration, and to the doleful mourn of pipes, Biddy was laid away. On the plaque, beneath the new armorial bearings they had given Biddy, was carved, "Sir Biddy, a true knight." They knew Biddy would have liked that. Patty, her face frozen in shock since she had first heard the news of his death, at the funeral's end was given the small packet they had found in his pocket. It was the locket. She numbly read the engraving on it. "To Patty, my future wife." The dam of her tears broke, and she collapsed across the sarcophagus, weeping uncontrollably. But Biddy was not really gone. He had become a legend. Future generations, if they survived, would hold in song and story the memory of Sir Biddy, who they said had saved the life of Johnny. Chapter 21. 1. The spacecraft Ocknar 2 rode in orbit 421 miles above the planet Earth. The small gray man sat in a small gray office in the ship. He was looking at small gray instruments. He was only partly finished with a critical analysis, and he was not even vaguely satisfied with it. A bottle of pills sat on his desk, pills for indigestion. His job had its drawbacks. Drinking all manner of hospitable offerings, including yarb tea, had upset his stomach. The small gray man was deeply troubled. The problems which assailed such a position as his were never easy. They required the most conservative possible judgment. He had faced many situations in his long life, a large number of them involving the most dangerous and overwhelming elements. But at no time, he did a hasty calculation with a rolling calculator, in 313,000 years, had he or his predecessors ever been confronted with the ruin potential of this one? He sighed and took another indigestion pill. This last packet of information that his communicator had given him contained elements which defied even the most expert mathematical dissection and reassembly. There were explosive elements in all this which could well wreak havoc. For one thing, a lightning storm had grossly interfered with the clarity of the first item. An infrabeam sound transmitter, no matter how narrowly it could be focused, was, after all, an electronic device, and interference was not only possible, it had happened. He considered himself no technician. That was not his role. But his technicians aboard could not get it clarified either. Compounding his trouble was this delay in all communications to competent labs. He was 2.5 months in travel time away from any such help. Wearily, he ran the data of the first item through the display machine for the 7th time. There was the compound, the old central cyclo mine site of the planet. There were some men in hiding behind rocks holding weapons. There was the arrival of the car, the departure of the first man into the compound. Then 3 men getting out of the car, 2 of them with weapons held on the third. He had tried and tried to get a clearer picture of the third man, but the interference due to the lightning was really bad. He once more got out one of the several one-credit bank notes he had managed to procure and studied the picture. But he could not be sure it was the same man. It was useless to call in a technician again. He had already done that. He let the signal decode into running visual again and spin forward. Then there came this second car, truck. A small figure leaping out holding some sort of weapon. The small figure racing forward to attack. It didn't really look like an attack. The man behind the rock might have thought it was an attack. Then the firing. He skimmed through the battle. Yes, it really must be the one on the banknote. What a perfectly poor transmission. They were usually so clear. Then the car, followed by horses and the man getting up on the car and talking to a crowd and holding the small body. This was where he had to have clarity, and he didn't have it. The vocal was so interrupted by the lightning that it was just sparks. Only a few bits came through. The picture showed arms being broken out, but not used. Was it a plea for no war by the man on the car? Who had that small body been to cause all this? A prince of a reigning sovereign? Well, thankfully, the infra-beam transmission from the island country was better, and the speech there came strong and clear. And it promised a war. But against whom? Why? It was the same man. The ship he had gotten into had been carefully tracked as it went over the pole of the planet. One could not be absolutely sure, however, that it was the same man as on the banknote. Firelight was a very long band, and almost went off the bottom of the infra-beam spectrum. The small gray man sighed again. He could not be sure at all. Not sure enough for a vital, critical analysis. He was just reaching for another pill when a light blinked from the people up on the flight deck. There was nothing much to do while in orbit, and a warning signal was a rarity. He tapped a button to light a screen and get the picture being relayed to him. And then he looked out the port. Ah, yes. He had half expected this. A war vessel. There it was, settling into orbit near them, bright and shining against the black sky. Always unnecessarily dramatic, these war vessels. Let's see, diamond with a slash, the insignia of the Tallneps. He had wondered when they would arrive. He flittered a rolling, lighted list in a round indicator on his desk. Tallnep. Tallnep war cruisers. Did that one out there have a diamond-shaped bridge? Yes. Vulcor class. Vulcor specifications. Ah, here it was. List weight 2,000 tons, solar-powered, main battery 64 Maxim blast cannons. How dull, these endless specifications. Who cared about the number of blast-type bulkheads? Ah. Complement 524 Tallnep Marines, 63 operating crew. Goodness, wouldn't one think that the computer clerks would realize the important items one would really want? Commanded by a half-captain, autonomous authority over local tactical conditions, but without authority over strategic decisions. That was what the small gray man was looking for. The local space communication buzzer went on. The small gray man turned a Visio screen on. The hard face of a Tallnep, topped by a small shield helmet, appeared. A half-captain insignia on the helmet. The small gray man knew he was talking to the vessel's commander. The small gray man flipped a little switch so the Tallnep screen would show his own face.
"Good spacing to you, sir," said the Tallnep. "I am Rogo Dieter Snowl."
He was speaking Cyclo, which was pretty universal. He adjusted thick glasses to better see the small gray man.
"Greetings, half-captain," said the small gray man. "Could we be of service to you?"
"Why, yes, Your Excellency. You might possibly oblige us with any vital information you might have regarding this planet."
The small gray man sighed.
"I am very much afraid, half-captain, that anything I have to give you has not yet resolved itself to critical analysis. It would not be complete, and while we are always happy to be of service, I fear we might erroneously advise you."
"Ah, well, it won't take very long to organize things here," said the Tallnep. "It's been a very long voyage, and my crew is still in deep sleep. But we can launch a party in the next few hours and obtain preliminary data."
The small gray man was afraid he would say that.
"I, of course, would not presume to thwart your intentions, half-captain, but I should think it would be very inadvisable."
"Oh? But a quick smash-bash, a few beings seized from here and there, and a rapid interrogation should give us all we need."
"Half-captain, I feel I should advise you that I do not think it would yield fruit. I have been collecting information for some time now, and have here anything you would get." I can transmit it over to you, whatever I happen to have.
That would be very thoughtful of you, Your Excellency. But why not a quick smash-bash minor raid? I detect some thoughts on this.
Well, as a matter of fact, said the small gray man, you do detect some reservations, and it is very acute of you. It might be important to stand off and wait.
Do you think they're the ones? Asked Snowl.
My dear fellow, said the small gray man, I believe there are 300 different planetary suspects.
302, I think, said Snowl. At least, that is the rumored figure.
We cannot tell you that this is the one, said the small gray man, and I can't give you comparative evidence about other planets and systems, for I am, of course, concerned with simply this sector, as you are. But it is my belief, based on very thin evidence, that this just could be the one.
Oh, I say, said the Tallnap. That's promising.
We are not in a position to adjudicate at this time, but it could be that a raid by you might disturb what appears to be a very critical political situation down there, and possibly disturb it to our disfavor.
You're advising us to wait, then, said the Tallnap.
Well, yes, said the small gray man. I will send you across any file data I have been collecting, and I think you will reach the same conclusion.
It's difficult, said the Tallnap. No raids, no prize money is our position. But we do have this other strategic thing.
Yes, and we should not make any tactical move that might upset it.
Ah,
said the Tallnap. Then,
how long would you think we should delay? Days, months, years?
Months, I should think.
The Tallnap sighed, then brightened and smiled. A Tallnap smile was a bit frightening, since their fangs were poison.
All right, Your Excellency. It is very courteous of you to offer the information, and I shall be very happy to review it. By the way, can we offer you escort and protection? I should think a Hockner ship might show up, and they are quite nasty, you know.
I do, thank you, Half-Captain, said the small gray man wearily. But, as you know, we have no quarrel ourselves with the Hockners.
No, of course not, said the Tallnap. Any supplies, anything like that we can provide?
Thank you, not just now. Possibly later. Your courtesy is always appreciated.
We are already in your debt, said the Tallnap, and laughed. Come across for tea sometime.
He clicked off. The very thought of more tea made the small gray man's stomach hurt. He reached for another indigestion pill. All things considered, this really was the worst hardcore problem that had ever come to his desk. The indigestion pill was about to take effect when he suddenly realized that the Balbods, the Hovins, and who knows who else might show up. He hoped they wouldn't quarrel with one another. In the situation he was in, it took months now to get proper reports home and months to hear anything. He felt very much on his own. He looked out the port again, at the gun-bristling monster of a war vessel, flashing along beside them in the glaring sunlight. Tough beings, the Tallnaps, but really not much worse than Balbods or Hockners. He glanced down at the planet face below them. Was it really the one? If it were, in one way it would be a relief. But if it were, what violence could go shooting down at it? His sigh was very deep. 2. Turl was purring. He was moving into his office today. There had been a few bad moments. This morning, he had sent Lars into it to make sure it was not booby-trapped. Better Lars blew up than he. The compound, in general, had been in a bit of a turmoil. General Smith had come down and commandeered all the dead bodies of the slaughtered commando, and had had a fight with a couple of his officers, apparently concerning mess table allocations. But Smith had resolved all that. There were 28 bodies, 18 active commandos. So he had hit on the masterful solution of one body to be issued to each commando, 2 to the officers' mess, 6 to the women and children, and 2 to his own table. So that had died down. The 13th commando had cleaned the place up, and the 5th commando had taken over the duty, all very smooth and military.
They were all very polite to Turl, and so it was obvious they knew who their boss was. But right after things had smoothed out, Lars came screaming back to the cage to tell Turl that the place was booby-trapped. Worse, he didn't have a clue how to disarm a booby-trap. Knowing he had better not let any of these Brigantes loose in the place, they'd stink it up and maybe blow it up, Turl himself had had to go in to handle the trap. It was right inside the knee-hole of the desk. Knowing that one booby-trap could have another under it to explode when the top one was removed, he had taken a lot of care to remove it. When he had disarmed it, he was about to throw it out when he saw that it had hairs stuck in it. They were gray cyclo-wrist hairs. Care's fur was orange. And somebody had broken a claw tip while pushing the plastic explosive down around the edges. It was too big a tip for it to be Care's. On hearing about this booby trap the first time, Turl had supposed it would be the animal's doings. According to what he had learned, the animal had remained behind after the other two left and probably had planted this trap. The fact that the animal had not come up and killed him too when the animal had wiped out this commando had troubled Turl. This was the second or third time the animal had had a chance to kill him, but had not done so. Eerie. Unnatural. So he had figured out that the animal, having planted this booby trap, thought it was all cared for. These bits of fur and the claw tip changed that. Once more, the animal had not killed him, or tried to. Very abnormal behavior. Turl finally came to a conclusion, however. The animal had been so beaten about by Turl that the animal was afraid of him. That was the right answer. Turl was comfortable with this until he realized that it was the cyclos down in the lower dormitory who had sneaked up here and planted the trap. Instantly, he demanded their slaughter. He didn't want them around anyway. But Lars had come back and said that that very morning all 33 of them had been removed under cadet guard and had been shipped overseas. And here was the requisition for goo food, kerbango, breathe gas, etc. to prove it. So Turl got over his fright and began to collect the odd bits, such as the dictionary and extra breathe gas files from the cage, walked out of it forever, and went back to his office. What a relief to be out of the sun and air of this accursed planet. He locked the door and turned on the breathe gas circulator, and soon he could take off his mask. What a relief to have a mask off. Turl looked around. Some things had been moved out. No drone recorders. Who wanted them? No radio links. So what? Compound intercoms all dead. Who cared? But the place was all set up to work. He thought one table was out of position and sought to move it, and found it was welded down. Even welded down with an armor weld. Ho ho, somebody wanted that table in exactly that place. Aha. That was why the animal remained behind. The place was bugged. They hadn't moved his clothes out. Later he would dress and become civilized again. But just now he wanted his green dress boots. There they were. They even had dust on the floor around them, and hadn't been moved an inch. He turned the right boot upside down, twisted the heel, and the cabinet keys fell out. He went back into the main office room. Aha! They had tried to jimmy the cabinets. There were the jimmy marks, and one door slightly bent. But Turl knew you couldn't jimmy security cabinets open. He unlocked them all. Everything, all in its same old place. Better and better. He picked up the bug detector, inspected it. He turned it on. And right away, a buzz. Lights flashing. Devils, but this place was really bugged. For a solid hour, Turl did nothing but remove bugs. Microphones, button cameras, scanners. All in very hidden places, all focused to zero in on the key work areas. 31 of them. He had been tossing them, when found, onto his desk. He counted again. 31. Oh, that animal had been busy. And stupid. Turl bet every other detector had been removed from the compound. Finally, he put on a tunic. Somebody had stacked a whole crate of Kerbango pans against the wall, and he was eyeing it. He was about to indulge when he thought, "Just one more sweep," and passed the bug detector around again. It whined. For 15 minutes he searched and searched. And then he found it. It was a micro set into the design of the top tunic button. He was wearing it. 32. He checked out all his other clothes. No more. He thought he had better look into the ducts visually. They didn't register on the detector, but who knew? But when he tried to steady himself on a chair by touching the duct frame, it was wobbly. No more of that. He could let air into this place. Shoddy work. But what could one expect? He surveyed the place again. He stood and laughed when he saw the components rack. Every assorted type of component, each with a big label above the box. And one of the button cameras he'd found hidden in a light fixture had been trained straight on it. Stupid animal. Then he suddenly realized there must be a planted feeder unit to power these bugs and relay their coverage. He put a mask on and got Lars. They went up and down the passageways, and there it was, a whole feeder unit, all wired up, right inside a recess closet for fire apparatus. He pulled it out and turned it off. Such a thing could run for half a year. And recorders? It must have been relaying two recorders. Within a few hundred feet. He went back and got a mine radio, turned the feeder on, and very shortly ran down the recorder. Just inside the garage door, where anyone could pass in and out to change its discs without much observation. Stupid animal. He turned the thing off and took it away. Who cared about any others? They were blind, now that they had no bugs to feed or record. Happily, he went back into his office, barred it, rechecked with his detector. Beautiful silence. No lights. Wonderful. Privacy at last. He put on some pants and boots. He opened up a pan of Kerbango and sank back in his chair, luxuriating. Home to wealth and power. That's where he was going now. And this time, he would set such a trap that the animal would be gobbled up if he even came near it. After nearly an hour, he thought he had better get to work. But first things first. He had better calculate how much time he had to get this job done. And then start on the construction of a weapon so lethal and deadly that the company never used it except in the extreme emergency of planet destruction. After he fired, this place would be just a smudge in the sky. He went to the cabinets and opened a false bottom. 3. Since his return to the African mine site, Johnny had had trouble getting to sleep at night. He would roll and toss on the oversized cyclo bed in the underground room he now used, uncomfortable in the overly hot and humid dark, going over and over again the steps and planning of recent past events, spotting where he had gone wrong in this and where he should have done something else in that. The life of a boy seemed far too much to pay for the information they had to have. Sir Robert was not here. He remained in Scotland organizing a perimeter anti-aircraft defense for Edinburgh. McKendrick was not here. He had taken a trip home to see to the movement of his underground hospital to more suitable quarters now available, and to check up on how his assistant was getting along. Colonel Ivan was in Russia. Stormalong had been detained here, for they were afraid some revenge might be taken upon him for lending his clothes and identity to the recent enterprise. Finding himself at loose ends, the Norwegian had kept himself busy inventorying the flying hardware, a name he had gotten from somewhere or invented for planes. Through Stormalong's efforts, Johnny had begun to divine the true character of his African base. Because it shipped very little bulk ore, they had roasted the tungsten down on the site, it had had none of the bulk ore carriers, a fact which made it necessary to truck out fuel and breathe gas from the branch mine site in the Ituri Forest. But this African Central
did have a great many other types of planes, which had led Stormalong to conclude that the base had also had a defense function. From some old cyclo manuals they had found, it seemed that in event of attack upon the mine site near Denver, this African base had the function of launching a counterattack to take an enemy by surprise. And this is exactly what these cyclos had been engaged upon when annihilated. It greatly intrigued Stormalong to find several types of flying hardware he had never seen before, and which weren't listed in current cyclo manuals. They were not battlecraft as such, however. They were dual-purpose machines brought in to perform a specific task, and then, that task done, rather typical of company policy, they had simply been dollied to the back of the hangar and forgotten. Too costly or too much trouble to return them to Cyclo. According to flight logs, still with them, they had been used to mine out an enormous amount of material which was found in orbit around this planet, a circumstance unusual in Cyclo experience. Some of the metals in these objects were priceless, being very scarce elsewhere, and the company had taken the unusual step of sending in some machines. If properly gasketed in its stores, due to its teleportation motors, which had no dependence upon air for lift, any common battle plane could fly to the moon and back without too much trouble. But they were not equipped to mine in space. You couldn't take objects in and out of a battle plane while flying in a vacuum. So some factory on Cyclo, or on a planet controlled by the Cyclos, had converted some very heavy-duty, armored marine attack planes. With atmosphere locks and remote-control grapplers, they could fly alongside some object in space, seize onto it, and put it in the hold. Some scraps of such recovered objects were still in the holds of these things, bits which had broken off, like nameplates. One said, NASA. And Stormalong tried to look it up in planetary lists and couldn't find it. Therefore, he had to conclude that it had been a local something. Johnny had looked at the old relics with some indifference. The gaskets on the doors were deteriorated. You can't expect a gasket to last for 1,100 years and still be airtight, he pointed out. Every hinge and ball joint in their cranes and doors was too stiff to operate properly. There were even some spider nests in them, and the spiders had dined for countless generations on another breed of insect that had dined upon the upholstery. The things were a mess. Johnny had been more interested in another craft, which mounted a blast cannon. But Stormalong, having some idle and recently trained mechanics and three spare pilots on his hands and full shops available, had put these relics in operating condition. He had even painted a burning torch on either side of its nose, which he said was a symbol of freedom. Stormalong had a lot of artistic style in him, Johnny had to admit, but he privately hoped the symbol didn't forecast the thing going down in flames. Not detecting the expected amount of enthusiasm, Stormalong had smugly pointed out, "Do you have anything else that could go up and visit those things orbiting 400 miles up there?" For some days now, there had been four bright objects in orbit. First, there had been one, then two, and now four. "Visit them?" said Johnny, aghast. "This thing doesn't even have guns anymore." "We put them back," said Stormalong. "And every screen and instrument in it works now. There were spares." "You better test fly it," said Johnny, "with a jet backpack close to hand." "I did," said Stormalong. "Yesterday. The console buttons are a bit old-fashioned, but it flies great." "Well, don't go flying up to those objects," said Johnny. "Oh, I didn't," said Stormalong. "I just took pictures of them." He had them. One was a big craft with a diamond-shaped bridge and a lot of blast gun snouts. One was a cylinder with a control deck in the front flat end. One was a thing which looked like a five-pointed star with a sort of gun on each star point, and the fourth was a sphere with a ring around it. "Hey," said Johnny, "that answers the description, the last one, of the small gray man's ship, the one you did but didn't crash into."
"Precisely," said Stormalong. "We're under surveillance."
Johnny had known they were under surveillance. No enemy had a monopoly on that. They had shifted their own drone pattern and control to Cornwall, and there were repeaters here. 12 drones, flying slow around the globe, were passing the American mine site every few hours. They were also recording the objects in orbit, though not so well, for drones were basically downlooking. No, a potential enemy had no monopoly, and ground defenses were also alert. But it was minimal defense, and Johnny knew it. Tonight he couldn't sleep at all. Dunnell Dean was overdue with the first recordings of Turl's activities, and Johnny didn't even know yet whether they would get recordings. Radio chatter about their project was forbidden. He was in the dark. He got up restlessly at last and paced about. Then he went outside the compound. Hot. Muggy. A lion was roaring down by the lake. The sky was overcast. Suddenly, he was overcome with the desire for some cool air and a look at stars. There were a couple of battle planes on standby, ready for a scramble if needed, but they were defense items. The ancient relic Stormalong had repaired was near at hand, a dull green in the glow of compound lights. On impulse, wanting only to do something besides brood, he went in to the duty officer and told him where he was going and got a mask and flight suit. True enough, the controls were a bit old-fashioned. The lift balance buttons were bigger and in a different place. The gun trips had been moved to make way for the crane controls. But so what? He put on a jet backpack, strapped himself in, closed all the windows tight, and vaulted the old wreck skyward. He burst through the overcast, and there were the stars. Johnny could always get a thrill from flying. Since that first enchanting day he had been aloft, he had never lost it. The black sky and bright stars, half a moon, some snow-capped peaks close by shoving their crowns up through the overcast and into the night sky. Johnny felt some of his tension ease away. He simply enjoyed it. It was certainly cooler now. Out of habit, he scanned his screens. Some blips. He looked through the screen for a visual check. 4 objects in orbit was what should be there. No, there were 5. 1 new object was approaching the 4 old ones, all brighter and steadier than stars, about 400 miles up. The last thing he was going to do was go up and visit them. Unknown ships there. He was flying a relatively untried ship here. He had no support. And even if this old relic could fly clear to the moon and back, he needed no additional incidents at this time, thank you. But maybe he could get some better pictures. Stormies, taken in daylight, had been fuzzy with ultraviolet. He threw his plane up to a height of 200 miles and closer to the objects, his attention mainly on putting the recorders on standby. What was that? A flash from the new 5th ship? Yes. Another flash. Were they shooting at him? Ready to take evasive action, he suddenly saw a wild flurry of flashes coming from one of the 4 objects, and a splash of light on the 5th. Hey! The 5th ship was shooting at one of the original 4, and that one was firing back. He quickly battered away at the old controls and closed the distance to about 150 miles. He was so intent on getting his recorders working, he didn't realize he was shooting in toward those ships at hypersonic maximum. Astonishing. The 5th ship and one of the original 4 were really having at it. Blast streaks were sheets of blue-green and red between them. Orange splashes of hits. Abruptly, he realized they were getting awfully big in his view screens. A cyclo-numbered digital was rolling up the narrowing distance. 75 miles. An instant before he pressed the console for a reverse roll and drive, the firing among the ships ceased abruptly. Johnny put his old wreck into a full power fall and got out of there. This was not his war. He didn't even know whether he had working guns. At about 100 miles above the Earth's surface, he eased off. He was about 50 miles up when he was flying level again. He looked back. They were not firing now, just sitting up there. The 5th ship seemed to have closed in on the others. This book is continued on cassette 4, side 1.